you Google on GoFundMe. We're trying to fund that project. Armand's boosting his Linktree. I should have mine at the ready, but I don't. And I don't know if we're live anymore, but folks can feel free to say their feelings and thoughts and just cavort until Pika kicks us out.
Let me do a 10-second rhyme real quick.
Let me do this one.
This one, our dads, all these little kids think I'm the man, but they don't know that everything that I do is haram. I called my mom. I said, I'm about to open up a shop on the block. She said, son, you need to open a Quran because Allah's got a different plan. You think you're poor? You need to visit Sudan. You ain't been to El Dahej, but you go to the jail every week just to visit your gang.
Gang.
On site. Thank you guys again for being here with us.
Yeah, thanks so much. We appreciate it. It means a lot. I'm sure all of you are kind of personal connections in a way, so we'll follow up in the future, but Tin Can Phone, look out and keep talking into the tin can.
Misfit Adi, Armand Poos, huh? The artist known as Michael Stevenson Jr., huh? Joe Rosenberger, that is, and this is Tin Can Phone.
You are listening to the Tin Can Phone podcast, where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the sources. We tell the stories from the inside out. So make sure to check us out on Cable Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m. You can also check us out on Spotify, Apple, and anywhere you love to catch your podcast. And make sure to give us a follow over at 10canphonepodcast.com. And follow our Instagram at 10canphonepodcast. This Misfit Adi signing off.
Hey, get a rhythm.
Come on over to Rhythm Shack with Mike Fisher for high energy roots rock, Americana, jam bands, blues and more every second and fifth Monday from 3 to 5:30 a.m. That's Rhythm Shack here on 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland and KBOO.FM.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland.
Hello and welcome to the KBO Bike Show coming from Portland, Oregon. I hope this finds you well. The show is broadcast on 90.7 FM and streaming live on KBO.org. My name is Alon Robb and I will be joined today by Nedra Deadweiler, our new co-host. A community activist from Atlanta, Georgia, she is a social worker with a master's degree in historic preservation and is the founder of Civil Bikes, leading tours along some of Atlanta's historical sites of racism and resistance. You could read more about Nedra on her website, civilbikes.com. Welcome aboard, Nedra. If you live in Portland, Oregon, perhaps you are taking part in Pedalpalooza, a summer-long celebration of bicycles. Started in 2003, it now encompasses hundreds of themed rides, bringing joy to the thousands of participants and helping foster a sense of community. The climate catastrophe weather we experienced lately, with temperatures over 40 degrees Celsius, has stopped some of the rides, but they are now again rolling on. Today's show will focus on cycling and mental well-being, a connection that was noted by cyclists since the earliest days of the vehicle. In the first half of today's show, we will speak with counselor and writer Will Hall, host of Madness Radio. In the second half of the show, we will speak with Catalan researcher Dr. Yoni Avila Palencia. Currently based at Philadelphia's Drexel University, she studies the connections between cycling and riders' self-perceived and actual health. Before we get to our guests, a few news items from the cycling universe. The Guardian and CBS report that during the pandemic, one positive development, has been the increase in the number of cyclists worldwide, as many people decided to avoid public transportation and also have discovered the benefits of exercise. The growing demand has led to shortages of bicycles and bicycle parts. The British company Halfords, which has hundreds of stores across the UK, reported that it has repaired and serviced more than 1 million bikes last year as people dug out old bicycles not used for many years. The officials predict that the shortage of bikes and bike parts will continue. The great demand has led to profits to rise for this particular company, nearly 200% over the previous year, and this boom has been shared by many manufacturers and retailers. Jason Dorman, who owns Summit Ski and Cycle in Los Angeles, said he has never seen a bike shortage like this before. The store ran out of bikes last year. Dorman said he thinks he won't have bikes to sell until next year. Until then, he is switching gears and focusing on bike repairs when he could get parts. Bikes would have to sit there for an extra couple of weeks just waiting on a part when usually we get it done in one day, he said. The prediction is that this shortage of bikes and parts will continue. And the Good News Network reports that MIT students created a bicycle-powered washing machine. Thanks to some MIT students, many people living without electricity may benefit from a new human-powered washing machine that could save them precious time and hard labor. The availability of a washing machine could also make a difference for the entire community by cutting down on water pollution created in open streams and lakes from doing wash by hand. The pedal-powered machine, built by MIT students and staff mostly from bicycle parts and empty barrels, could also be built locally and thereby create jobs. The motor of the machine consists of a bicycle frame with a chain running forward to a gear at the end of the washer drum's shaft. The highest gear is the spin cycle and the lowest gear is the wash cycle. The new machine was recently tested at an orphanage in the Lima, Peru neighborhood. And these are a couple of news items from the vast universe of cycling.
Wheels up around the country, early days in the wheels up around the country, Lord. Bicycle for me, we ride bicycle, 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 we have we ride bicycle. Say from downtown, this is straight to 3 miles. Got early be him on the court profile. One time bicycle used to rule the city. Say every youth man and them are delay dally. See the Beijing young and this Conglass passe. Say every man a ride a 21 free rally. We say flashes go a dance, flashes go a movie. Every cycle have a lock on the owner of the key. Mechanical beats just say hold it steady. Red lamp and generator when me make me night spray. Me back with me tool for emergency. Say pass up from me spooks, make it shine like money. Me have me chain down so me pants foot free. Say watch a doctor in my delay dally. Gets the old lady and the pregnant mommy. Now me have me pass the way I make a small trip. No breaks, we are drawn up. Tires are cheap, ten catching you a ton and country day straight. Me make a pussy ride and my foot make a slip. Bicycle start head for a pile of brick. You have to find something if me want exist. Me squeeze the two bricks, put the iron them twist. I throw the two fender, make ya show it. So, up in a saddle like a witch stand with it. Then me steady on the pedal, then me free the ratchet. Put me knee against the bar, I make two flick. Bicycle rig up like when I start panic. The way me a go, me a fi turn opposite. Countryman ball out, say this is magic. Say cool daddy you, early me a practice. Just give me a orange, make me go and wait me lip. Bicycle, bicycle, make me ride bicycle. Now watch it doctor, he ma make a next ride. Say from downtown up to Puppet Square. Say wish for me a start down a Victoria Pier. Me warm up myself with a nice cold beer. Say up King Street and me take the corner. Ooh, past the tree, them say the jelly water. Say
say up a rain street, me pass Mazooka. And when me reach across road, say me gonna theater. And when me thirsty, me jump me back the water. Bicycle, bicycle, make me ride bicycle. Ca watch a little wasa need my ride bicycle. Ca watch a miss a boat and need my ride bicycle. Say watch the ass man and need my ride bicycle. Say from 3 miles and we reach up a pain. Ca few bicycle line out from the scene. Ca man is king and missing woman them a queen. But at any rate we go we cause good fun. They say bicycle, bicycle, make we ride bicycle. Say from downtown we say straight to 3 miles. Ca really be a mother full profile. One time bicycle used to run the city. Say every youth man and them a delay dolly. See the Beijing gang and the Spanglass posse. Say every man a ride a 21 frame rally. They say flashes go a dance, flashes go a movie. Every cycle have a lock and the owner have the key. Mechanical bricks just say hold it steady. Headlamp and generator when me make me night spray. Me bag with me tool for emergency. Say brass up on me spokes, make it shine like money. Me have a chain yard so me fans full free. Bicycle, bicycle, make me ride bicycle.
And that was Early B singing Bicycle, Bicycle. You're listening to the KBO Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, on 90.7 FM and streaming live on KBO.org. The show is archived on bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. Today's show is about cycling and mental well-being. Our first guest, interviewed by Nedra Deadweiler, is counselor, facilitator, and author Will Hall. He is the host of Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, a show carried on the Pacifica Network. On his website, willhall.net, he writes that, quote, "My work and learning arose from my own experiences of recovery from madness, and today I am passionate about new visions of mind and what it means to be human."
Thank you so much, Will, for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited about this invitation. I really appreciate it. I would like to say a prayer to the spirit of all the bicycles that I have ever owned or ridden and thank them for helping my mental health, because I mean, it's wonderful to be on the show and thinking about that connection. Bicycles have been really super important for me throughout my life, and it's been really nice to reflect on that and to appreciate that. And I think there's something very special about the bicycle, and I think that it goes very deep into who we are. People who are bicycle owners and bicycle lovers really kind of get it about bicycling. And so it's great to have the opportunity to talk about that. It's part of our bodies. I mean, I grew up in like a lot of people who have who have mental health struggles. You know, I was diagnosed with schizophrenia. It's a big, scary word. I had a lot of really difficult times in my life. And I grew up like a lot of us who have those struggles in a very chaotic family situation. I don't blame my parents. They have their history from their parents, and it goes all the way back through the generations, right? But one of the things that I did, one of the places that I felt powerful and free as a kid, was riding my bike really, really as fast as I could. You know, I had like a Schwinn 5-speed, and I would be like, this is warp fast factor 3, this is warp factor 4, this is warp factor 5. And bikes have always been a space where I immediately feel more at home, more myself, more empowered. And that's been throughout my life. I was really inspired. I do a little bit of art, and I was really inspired just by this image. And the image is of just a bicycle. I made this as a drawing, and it's an image of a bicycle sign, just a bicycle. And then the top says, "They told me I have schizophrenia." And then the bottom is, "I told them I have a bicycle." It's really a clash of meanings, and it's a clash of different stories, because a lot of us are told we're broken, there's something wrong with our brains. You're human, but you're not quite like the rest of us. Just take your medications, keep quiet. My path has been completely different from that. I'm not against medications. I know that the system has helped some people. The system really failed me and really made things really worse for me in a lot of ways. I don't take medications. I'm one of those people you don't hear about, the people with the schizophrenia or bipolar or psychosis diagnosis that don't take medications. And reflecting how I did it, a lot of it was just being able to be in the world. And the bicycle helped me to be out in the world, exercise, connecting with my body, connecting with nature, and also to feel less alienated in cities. Because I think all of us know that, you know, if it's a car, you're walking or on public transit, I've been very privileged to have an able body and I can ride a bicycle. So to be able to have that kind of victory over the city that I think a lot of bicyclists feel when you're weaving in and out of traffic, or you hop up on the sidewalk, or you can just pick up the bike and go up the stairs. I mean, that feeling of overcoming that alienation is extremely important to me. And I'm thinking of, there's an author, Ivan Illich, who's been very influential to me, who wrote some books about appropriate technology and the connection between urban design and technology and the environment. And he really points out that a bicycle is really a very human kind of technology. It's a very forgiving, inviting, welcoming, human-level technology. It's not an alienating tool. It's more of a convivial, supportive tool. So I feel very grateful to the bicycles in my life. And if you can't ride a bike, then walk, but do something to get out there. You know, it makes a big difference for mental health. I ride a Dutch one-speed, okay. Actually. Years ago, I was in Amsterdam, and I just fell in love with the upright granny bikes, and which is a real different experience than a mountain bike or something that you're hunched over on. Really, it lifts you up. All of your weight is in your hips. Your shoulders are completely free and open. You can have a conversation with the person that you're riding with. You can look around. And that it's a bit of a conversation starter. You don't see a lot of the Dutch granny bikes around. So I used to live in Portland, which is like serious bike culture. And some of the guys on fixies are like these high tech, like $3,000 bikes would kind of look at me sideways. But every now and then, like, hey, cool bike, that's awesome. And sort of an expression of my personality, and also like a bit of a protest, because I have to say there's a capitalist politics of the bicycle industry.
This is a coordinated monthly test of the emergency alert system through broadcast stations in the greater Portland-Vancouver area, including Clackamas, Columbia, Multnomah, and Washington counties in Oregon, and Clark County in Washington. With the cooperation of public safety broadcasters and cable operators, this system informs you of events that pose an immediate threat to your life, health, or property. If this had been an actual emergency, official information would have followed the alert tone. This test was originated by Clackamas County in Oregon. This concludes this test message.
Vital feeling sometimes, okay, maybe you're different. Doesn't mean you're less than. Doesn't mean that you should be pushed into the shadows. Because psychiatry also told lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans people that we were diseased, and we were mentally ill, and we were locked into asylums. We were literally tortured to death because we were different in our sexuality or our gender. And so a big part of my message now is like, no, embrace your difference. I mean, yeah, there's suffering. I want people to overcome suffering, but the way necessarily isn't to get rid of being different. Maybe the way is to embrace being different, but then find friendship and community and a sense of empowerment. So a lot of my work these days is really helping people find each other, find communities like the Hearing Voices movement, find organizations of patient survivors, and talk about our common experiences and not be alone. Because as we know, oppression is about divide and conquer. That's what it's about. So if we can unite and come together, I believe that we can make the world a better place for everybody, no matter what your mind is doing that's different than everybody else.
What are some changes that you've noticed, even more recently, changes in mental health that hurts to have?
Well, it's a power struggle. It's a political struggle. It's a result of the patients' movement, just like the women's movement. We wouldn't have access to reproductive health care or access to midwives or choices around pregnancy or all the different things that we now have thanks to the women's movement, feminism, women organizing. And so a lot of the protections and changes that are in place, there's not enough, but a lot of the protections and changes that have taken place in the mental health system, it's a result of patients' movement. And one of the big changes that I've seen is that this idea of peer support, that when you've been in the system, you learn things, you know what it takes, you know how to survive, you know how to make it through, and then you can support other people. We know this from like AA, when you're struggling with addiction, do you want to go to somebody who's read books about addiction and got a license in addictionology? Or do you want to meet somebody who's been through it and get some ideas and some support? We need more alternatives to hospitals. We need more alternatives to diagnosis. We need really community-based options. But it is starting to grow. And the second thing I think is that's coming from the Black Lives Matter movement, which is so important, is getting police out of mental health. I mean, police should not be the, I need help in my community, who should I call? Let me call 911 and they send a guy with a gun who's trained to kill terrorists to my door. It should be, look, let's send peers. Let's send people who've been through it. People ask me like, Will, what changes would you like to see in the mental health system? Actually, I would like to abolish the mental health system. I would like to see communities that are healthy enough that we can take care of each other, that we don't need those big institutions. If you look at the history of the asylums and the psychiatric hospitals, it was always about population control. So what I think fundamentally we need is healthy communities. You know, it's hard to have a healthy community when people are working 60 hours for $8 an hour. It's hard to have a healthy community when you don't have universal health care. It's hard to have a healthy community when you don't have childcare or you don't have access to education. When the people at the margins get freedom and we get changes, it helps everybody. If the people who are diagnosed with schizophrenia or bipolar, if we can be freer to express our emotions, to express our needs, to express our sensitivities, guess what? That's going to help everybody, because this is a continuum. The only difference between me and you is that I'm a little bit more extreme on the continuum. We're struggling with the same kinds of issues of loneliness, powerlessness, trauma, poverty, and alienating society. So I have seen a lot of change. There's a lot of encouragement, but change doesn't just happen because you wait. It's because there's movements. So get involved in the movements, be activists. That's crucial.
Were there some suggestions of ways to plug in?
I would hope that it has traction enough. I mean, it's obviously going to be easier to go shopping. I mean, capitalism makes onboarding really easy. It's hard to, but I would just say be persistent. I mean, there's a whole kind of underground. It really is like a countercultural, like samizdat dissident literature out there. It's sort of like the women's movement in the 30s or the gay movement in the 40s. Like it's out there, but you have to look for it because it hasn't really, but like Mad in America, .com is a great resource. The Inner Compass Withdrawal Project is great around medications. The Hearing Voices Movement, .net. I created a radio show, Madness Radio. I'll travel around. I do trainings and workshops and things, and I'll talk to people and even strangers, and I tell them what I do. And almost immediately, they'll say, I have a brother, or I have a friend, or some coworker. And so this is an issue that affects all of us, and there may be alternatives achieving some of the same kinds of usefulness.
How can folks who are not directly experiencing certain experiences be supportive?
That's a really great question. Well, I think we have to remember that we're all on a continuum. So even if someone has an extreme experience, like they feel suicidal or they've got a persecutory voice, that's not very far from your experience of feeling despair or like you want to give up, or you're afraid or mistrustful. So one of the first things that I'm encouraging people to do, if they want to be an ally, they want to be a supporter, is to open up about your own personal experience. And, you know, kind of like step into that vulnerable space first. Like, hey, you know, I did have some addiction issues. Like, you know, there was a time when I was feeling suicidal. Right. With the person, you're like, hey, we're in this together and we're going to try and help solve these things together.
Going back to the bike and just that sense of freedom and being able to rise above. And it's not even a rising above. It's almost like moving to maybe where we really truly are meant to be. That sense of freedom and not being oppressed. I know when I am on a bike, I feel better mentally, emotionally, physically. I rode my bike probably twice this weekend. Oh my God. Like that changed everything.
Totally. Totally.
What was that change in your life? I mean, was it a bicycle ride? Was this like,
It's a great question. Yeah. It's a great question. I mean, just thinking about bicycles, wouldn't it be great if we lived in a world where when you're depressed, you get a prescription to ride a bicycle.
Yeah.
You know, or a prescription to walk or go to the gym but it's a really big question. I mean, it took me many years. I was on disability for 15 years. You know, I struggled a lot. And looking back on that, it was friendship. It was finding the patient survivor movement where I could be among people that I didn't feel like I was outside. I felt like I was inside. I wasn't pushed to the margins. I think the issue isn't that people are different or weird or they're hearing voices or they're paranoid. I think the issue is that we're isolated, we're disconnected. And so little acts of connection over and over and over again. But if we separate people and isolate them and put them in the shadows, then we don't have a chance to connect with each other and learn from each other, because you know people have really learned a lot of pathways through something like bipolar or something like schizophrenia or extreme depression or suicidal feelings. And there's a lot of knowledge out there, but we're so focused on the experts that we're not building the communities. I mean, what if every community had places and centers to go that people could connect with each other? You know, I'm a big believer in like trying lots of different things, or for anyone, I would love if they just had like some supporters saying, hey, let's try this, let's try that, let's try more connection with your family, let's try taking a break from your family, let's try some nutrition changes. Like, I have to say, like with so-called manic crisis, that's one of the main reasons that people get a bipolar diagnosis. Sleep is a huge issue. So I work with a lot of people around like how to regulate your sleep. Like your friends are staying up till 2 a.m. playing video games. You can't do that. You got to get to sleep. And people have to learn trial and error, experiment. And what if we had a society where we were not tolerating, you know, 26-hour shifts for the nursing profession, and we weren't tolerating crunch time at the software place where people are up at 4 a.m. What if we had more of a realization that, look, we have to be sensitive that some people are going to be more vulnerable to sleep deprivation than others. We had like an educational approach in the society. What if we had a society where people were encouraged to talk to each other and to not refer to an expert if they have difficulty? Yeah. Connect them with this treatment service. And that might be helpful for some people, but mostly just having the confidence to say, hey, let's talk. And what you're going through is probably no different than what I've been through, maybe more extreme right now. But we have a human capacity to connect with each other through the power of listening. And if we believe in it, I think we should teach listening skills in high school. We should teach parents how to listen to their kids and how to support their kids. And we have to realize also that the solution is not just treating trauma, because I believe we need new treatments for trauma, and there's psychedelics coming out, and there's all kinds of different things that are coming for trauma. We need to get serious about preventing trauma in the first place, and seeing the connection between poverty and racism and trauma, and the incredible pressure we put on families because of the economic situation. We could deal with a lot of domestic violence if women just simply had a guaranteed safety net that they wouldn't be afraid of relying on their husband or their boyfriend for economics. You know, if they could just be free to go get their own place or move out, that would really help a lot.
A guaranteed income. I mean,
guaranteed base. Absolutely. Absolutely.
How are you inspiring people? You have a radio show, trainings, but in your day-to-day life, how would you say that you're inspiring people to think differently and to see themselves differently, see the world and in other possibilities?
Yeah. Well, if as long as the person isn't going to start really having some kind of discriminatory or frightened or hostile attitude towards me, which I can feel out pretty quickly, I try and disclose about my personal experience. I try and talk about the fact that I was diagnosed, that I hear voices, that I still hear voices. I still go through suicidal feelings sometimes. I don't take medications. And so I'm creating these little conversations all the time that I hope are going to kind of sort of spread out. I think that's one of the main things we can do, because anytime there's a taboo, if you could just break the taboo by being the first person who steps out and starts to talk about it, I think it really makes a big difference. And so for people to have the courage to do that, and to make that. And I have to say, the Black Lives Matter movement has done an incredible job of raising the issue of coercive treatment, because we know that the police are responding to mental health calls and then killing people or beating them or escalating or worsening the situation. And we also know that a lot of folks that just end up locked up in the hospital, it's not much different than being locked up in jail. And Black Lives Matter has been making those connections in a very strong way. And so that, I think, is what gives me hope for the future. Because when people start to say, well, what would it be like to rely less on police or not rely on police at all? It's not about defund the community. It's a defund the police, but increase the funds to the community, more resources. And then people say, well, what resources? And they say, well, let's talk about mental health. You know, let's talk about, because we live in a society that's based on isolation and fear and competition and selfishness. Mm-hmm. And until we break that, until we have a society that's based on mutual aid and healthy communities and caring for each other, and everyone has their guaranteed basic human rights, we're not going to solve mental health problems. It's totally connected with this larger issue of neoliberal capitalism and how to create some kind of democratic socialism, or whatever you want to call it, some kind of alternative society. So I'm very inspired by Black Lives Matter and the Bernie campaign and young people who are really thinking big about how do we actually solve these problems rather than just be activists forever and try and raise money to protest. You got to really come up with some solutions. And I talk about my mom a lot. She was involved 40 years ago in helping organize a a rape crisis center and shelter in Sarasota, Florida, which is still around. So she really taught me about activism. And that was one of the brilliance of the women's movement, is that women got together in these consciousness raising groups and they talked about their intimate personal lives. And then they connected it with the larger structural social problems of patriarchy and capitalism and racism. And that's what I see happens every time I sit down with someone to talk about their mental health issues. Issues of toxic masculinity come in, issues of racism and separation and the way in which racism still persists, and the segregation is right there. Poverty issues are right there. Homeless issues are right there. And then as the experts come in, they say, no, we don't want to talk about that. We just want to talk about treating the disease of your brain. Well, wait a second, I'm connected to the whole society here. If you really want to build healthy mental health, you have to build a healthy community, and we have to overcome this legacy of racist capitalism that we're still living inside of.
Everything is interconnected. What we saw in 2020 gave us a real good lesson, and even like a playbook of how to build mutual aid systems, how to create a new pathway. I mean, we do that on a bicycle, like you're new to town or you're traveling, you go this way and then you come back another way and you go out again a different direction, just to explore, to engage something new internally as well as externally. Creating a new route and being open to the conversations that you have along that way. The butterflies, or be it with the person who's on the sidewalk, opening.
It was amazing that, the pandemic really showed us some hopefulness. Like, first of all, the willingness of people to make a sacrifice, like people just stopped, they sacrificed economically, and then, and also the incredible concern and mutual aid. Think what society would be like if we all had the time and the freedom, if we had guaranteed income, or we had decent enough jobs, we didn't have to work as much as we do. We had all this free time that we could actually meet our neighbors. We could meet the neighborhood, we could be involved in the community. We often just don't have that simple resource of time availability. And that's often all people need. It's just someone to sit with them and to be with them. It's not a lack of resources, it's where the resources are distributed. They're at the top of the economy, they're in the billionaire 1% class, being invested in hedge funds and speculative gambling capitalism. But this is the richest country in human history. We can afford basic needs, and we can start building basic needs globally. We can do it, but not unless we ask for it and demand it politically, which is, I hope that people would start to see the mental health dimension part of that larger social struggle that needs to happen. But something has got to change fundamentally. It absolutely has. And maybe it's a totally new language. Maybe it's a completely different vision that comes forward. Be there to support someone who's afraid. We all know how to do that. Gentleness, listening, an open heart, caring, empowering the person, giving them choices, trying different things, being curious, showing them that you care, being honest with them, being vulnerable, opening up about your own struggles so that they don't feel separate or alien. Just human, basic human common sense really is what we need. If we surface the fact that we're all unique, that nobody is normal, and we all need to be listened to, then it's not, how do we take care of those different people over there? Then it's more like, hey, those different people over there are reminding us that all of us need to be listened to. All of us have unmet needs. All of us have emotions that we don't know how to express. Bring that mental diversity in, as I hope we're starting to do. We're starting to have less of an ableism that says one standard. And I mean, the autism movement has done incredible things for this. The anti-racism movement has done incredible things for this, because it's really like a cultural diversity issue in a lot of ways. But we don't want to just have tokenism or just have everybody in the capitalist workplace. We want to realize that, look, the whole system has to change, because we have to stop oppressing people. That oppression has both economic, political, and also mental health impacts on people, and that's ultimately what people are suffering from, is a lack of empowerment, a lack of true representation, a lack of true involvement, and a lack of true control over their destinies, which is fundamentally what I think liberation movements are all about.
We're gonna put a pin in that.
Okay.
But just to go back to your bicycle.
Yes.
What color is your bicycle?
And is black. It's a black bicycle. It does not have a name. But that's an interesting question. Maybe one day it'll tell me its name. I'll find out.
Yes. Yeah. They are. Yeah. Well, it was really great to meet you. I hope that I see you on a path somewhere.
Yeah.
And that you still have your long hair. Okay, audience, you can't see this, but you're on Zoom, so then I will know who you are.
Yeah.
As a result. So.
Yeah, maybe on a critical mass bike ride somewhere.
On a critical mass in some city or some country,
Or another planet. Who knows what will happen?
Or another planet. Ability. I appreciate it. I think anyone listening to this will find several gems to inspire them to take some action. As a person who I think I thrive on authentic connection, I feel like to think about mental health in a different way today helped me to do that.
It's such a pleasure to be part of this conversation. I really appreciate you inviting me.
Yeah. Till next time.
Okay, till next time.
You are listening to the KBO Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming live on KBO.org. The show is archived on www.bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. We just heard counselor and facilitator Will Hall talk about madness, labeling, and recovery, and the place of the bicycle in this process. In the second half of the show, our guest will be Dr. Iona Vila-Palencia, whose work centers on cycling's effect on mental well-being. Good day and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Before we start with your studies, can you please tell us a little bit about your own background?
Okay, so my name is Iona Vila-Palencia. I studied environmental sciences in Barcelona, and then some years after, I decided to do a master in public health, and from there I decided to do a PhD in environmental epidemiology. And during my PhD, I was mainly focused in looking associations between transport and health.
And you grew up in Barcelona?
Yes, I'm born and raised in Barcelona City, yes.
And what is it like to be a cyclist in Barcelona? Would you say it's a friendly city for bicyclists?
Yeah, I mean, it always depends on what you compare with, right? Mm-hmm. But I personally think it is kind of bike friendly. Of course, there's still some work to do. They could increase way more, like the number and the length of bike lanes. But I think it's improving. The thing is, the last 2 years, I haven't been there, and I know that now, because of COVID, they have been doing a lot of improvements, so I cannot really say how is it right now, but what I've heard it is getting even better.
You conducted several studies with several other researchers. Can you please tell us a little bit about those studies?
Okay, so when I was doing my PhD, first, I analyzed some data from a survey that it was carried on only in the Barcelona city, and it was focused in cycling commuting. So in this study, what I looked, it was the association between bicycle commuting and perceived stress. And what we found is that those who bicycle to go to work or study show lower levels of perceived stress. And then also during my PhD, I worked in a European project, it was called PASTA. And this project carried a longitudinal study in which we recruit to around 2,000 participants in seven European cities, so 2,000 participants in each of the seven European cities, and one of them was Barcelona. And we send them questionnaires for 2 years, asking questions about their transport behaviors and different measures like physical activity. And at the end of the longitudinal study, we also ask questions about mental health and well-being. And also, apart from that, we also did other sub-studies, one in which we recruit a small sample of people in which they had to wear different sensors for 1 week, and those sensors were measuring physical activity levels. They were also GPS and also sensors that measure air pollution. So we, in this study, we were looking also, for example, interaction between physical activity and air pollution and how this affects different health outcomes. And then we also did another study in which the participants had to download a smartphone app. And this smartphone app identified the different transport modes that they were using during the day and which routes were doing during the day. So in general, this big project tried to answer questions related to transport behaviors in big cities in Europe and association of those behaviors with different health outcomes. And I specifically was focused in looking associations with mental health, well-being, and social interaction. And what we found is that actually comparing different transport modes, cycling was the one that was giving more robust results related to mental health. And the results were that those who cycle had better mental health and higher social interaction.
The study in Barcelona, how is stress measured? And if it's self-reporting, do you feel that that is an accurate measure of stress?
Yeah, so actually what in the study in Barcelona, which was TAPAS study, what we used, it was a scale that specifically measures self-perceived stress. So the idea is that the participants are saying their own perception of how stressed they are. So it's actually, the idea is that actually it's a good measure because they are expressing their perception about their stress level. But of course, there are also other kind of measure, more objective measures, for example, with sensors that can measure like more objective ways of stress and based in more like physical reactions of the body. But then it's another kind of measurement.
And do you try to get a sample of a pretty accurate sample of the population, or how did you find these individuals?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So actually, in those studies that we carried different surveys, the recruitment strategy was opportunistic. In when I say opportunistic, I mean that at the end, like the people that was recruited were the people who were willing to participate, but we tried to do it as much representative as we could. And to do that is that to recruit people, we contract recruiters. So there were people in the street catching people's attention and asking them to participate. And what we did is we took the map of Barcelona and we identified different areas in the city, taking into account different demographic characteristics of the neighborhood. And we asked the recruiters to go to certain areas in different moments to make sure or try to make sure that we were covering the different neighborhoods and different demographics. But as I said before, it's an opportunistic strategy. So at the end, those who say yes are those who are, by definition, motivated to participate in a study like that.
And is the reduction in stress connected to the amount of cycling one does, the frequency, or where they do it? Let's say if they cycle in a busy city street versus a countryside. Does it matter if they cycle 5 days a week or one day?
So yeah, as you said, like all those studies were focused in urban areas. So we cannot compare like cycling in rural areas, but in the study that we did in Barcelona, we actually found that those who cycled more frequently were those who had lower perceived stress. And the idea, I mean, from those results, I cannot tell you exactly why, but the idea behind of all that is that one of the main mechanisms is that when you are cycling, you are increasing your physical activity levels. And there's plenty of research that associates physical activity with better mental health. This is one thing. But then there's other kind kind of research that also suggests that just the fact of using a bike and traveling and cycling itself, it's associated with being a pleasant way of moving around the city. And it's also associated with better perception of your environment, etc. So there's also this idea that just because of the pleasure of cycling, your mental health improves.
From my own experience of cycling every day, doing some exercise, walking with the dogs in the forest, playing football, it seems to me that every activity, physical activity, has positive effects on me, but maybe something about cycling does have an extra element. I'm not sure. That would be hard to measure, I think.
Yeah, so as I said, I mean, from the kind of studies that I carry out, I cannot take clear conclusions about that. Mm-hmm. But there's this idea that just cycling itself is associated with also different kinds of lifestyles and also things related to identity, that the fact that you identify as a cyclist, like it gives you an extra benefit.
Let's move on to the multi-city study. So can you give us a little more, talk a little bit more about that study?
Okay, so this was a study that we carried in 7 European cities. Those cities were Barcelona, London, Antwerp in Belgium, Rome, and Zurich, and Örebro in Sweden. So it was a study run in 7 cities. And as I said, we recruit around 2,000 participants in each of these cities. And those participants have to answer different questionnaires for 2 years. And during these 2 years, in those questionnaires, they were mainly asked questions about their transport behaviors, physical activity, and also there were questions about if they had any accident, etc. And at the end of the study, we included questions about mental health, well-being, and social interaction. In this study, what we did is that we compare different transport modes, where car, motorbike, public transport, e-bike, bike, and walking. And we looked at the association of those different transport modes with different mental health measurements. And what we found is that cycling, like bike use, was the one who was associated with more mental health outcomes and with positive mental health outcomes, and in comparison with the others. And for example, what we found is that also walking, for example, was associated with better social interaction, the main result.
And what do you mean by positive mental health?
So what I mean with that is that we use different outcomes. We use mental health, vitality, and perceived stress. So what we found is that bike was associated with better mental health, higher vitality, and lower perceived stress.
And is there a difference between the different cities? I mean, Zurich and Rome are so different as far as the streets, the way things are run.
Yes, but the thing is that in this kind of studies, generally what you're trying to do is that the idea is that you are not trying to compare cities.
Mm-hmm.
You are pulling the cities so you can take a general conclusion of the area. So in this case, it's about European cities,
mm-hmm.
right? So in this specific study, we didn't go to the detail of comparing the results by cities and why. Mm-hmm. The idea was to say more like in general, okay, we can pull all those different cities and we can see a general trend that if we have more cycling in the cities, we will have better mental health in the population. It's actually a quite common practice in those big international projects. Like, for example, in the project that I am now, we are studying Latin American cities. And the idea is that we are pulling big data from many different cities in order to get more like general conclusions of the region.
And is the current study in Latin American cities also involving cycling?
Yes. So there's some data about cycling, mm-hmm. but it's not the main objective as it was in the European study.
You mentioned also about the European study that there are, one result is better social interactions. What do you mean by that exactly?
Yeah, so we used a measure that we called social contact, and it was based in some questions in the questionnaire that were asking how frequently you visit your friends and your family, etc. So we just took those questions and we create a kind of cutoff, like saying, taking the average and saying, okay, those who have seen their friends and family more than X days, we consider that they have higher social contact, and below that, we consider that they have lower social contact.
And are there any differences between men and women, young and old, maybe immigrants and people who've been in the cities for a long time?
Yeah, that's also a very good question. So we didn't go into this detail in this study, but there's literature that says that generally men cycle more than women, or younger people also cycle more than older people. And this has a lot to do with the infrastructure that is actually facilitated to cyclists. Generally, women has been seen that if they feel less safe, or they feel that the environment is less pleasant, they tend to cycle less. So generally, if you look into cities where there's good infrastructure, like safe infrastructure, and also like the environment is like nicer, you have more trees, etc., generally women tend to cycle more. And the same with older populations.
In our show 2 months ago, we interviewed several women cyclists in the Middle East, and they spoke of some added stresses, societal pressures, prohibitions, sometimes being harassed while they're cycling.
Yeah,
those are added pressures. Have these studies been made public? Have you tried to reach city planners and policymakers?
Yeah, so actually especially in the PASTA project, we had a lot of interactions with the stakeholders, because they were part of the project, and especially because of the publication of this study about mental health and other studies from PASTA in Barcelona, people from what is called Diputació de Barcelona, which is an institution that is in charge of doing the city, the urban planning and transport plans for the Barcelona province, except Barcelona City, they contact us and they ask us if we could create a course in which we could train the technicians and help them to try to incorporate the health approach into the process when they were developing those plans. So that was actually a very cool experience, because we developed this course, myself and a colleague, in a collaboration with them. And we had like a couple of sessions with those technicians, and we analyzed the transfer plans of certain cities, and we analyzed certain interventions, and we asked them to do qualitative health impact assessments, which means that they should rethink those interventions, taking into account what effect they could have on health. The idea is that after this, well, I think, I hope this is something that they are going to incorporate in the process when they do the transfer plan.
And if Catalonia becomes independent, as some of my friends in Barcelona want and are active in that campaign, maybe cycling will be made really important in the new state. What is next for you? If you looked at your crystal ball, where might you be in 10, 15, 20 years? What kind of studies do you want to do then?
That's almost a life question. Okay, so for now, I'm a a postdoctoral researcher here at Drexel, and my idea is to stay in academia, and if I keep being in academia, I personally want to be involved in studies that are more applied,
mm-hmm.
and that they involve decision makers and interactions with the stakeholders, because I personally think that that's the way to go.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And the kind of studies that I would like to do more, well, first I would like to do more studies about evaluating interventions. Like, for example, when an intervention is done in a city, for example, a new bike lane or whatever, be able to measure, for example, before and after, and see if this intervention is having an effect, and see how it can be improved. So I think more studies like this are needed right now. And then also I would like to learn a bit more about the health impact assessment. I personally haven't done that almost nothing about that, but there's a lot of nice research out there and a lot of good researchers doing these predictions of like, okay, so if we have this intervention, for example, and if we, for example, in the case of Philadelphia, there was a health impact assessment published some time ago saying like, okay, if we increase the number of trees in the city, what would happen? How many deaths we could prevent, or how many cases of whatever disease we could prevent? I would like to do things more like that. So at the end, for example, evaluating interventions, I think the idea is actually to be able to see if things work, right? And if they work, why they work, and if they don't work, why they don't work, and how can we do it better? And here it would come like the process of exchanging with the stakeholders.
The last year with the pandemic has been so horrible, and with so much suffering and death. But one good thing, at least one good thing that came out, is the growing interest in bicycles as more and more people realize the benefits of cycling. Our time is up, and I would like to thank you for your insights and your important studies, and I wish you much success. And of course,
you are listening to the KBO Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, on 90.7 FM, and streaming live on KBO.org. The show is archived at www. Thank you.
listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy miércoles 7 de julio del 2021. Mientras Inglaterra avanza hacia el levantamiento anticipado de las restricciones del coronavirus el 19 de julio, un alto funcionario de la Organización Mundial de la Salud ha ofrecido una advertencia contundente a los países para que levanten sus restricciones del COVID-19 lentamente para no perder las ganancias que ellos han logrado en contra del virus. Los comentarios del jefe de emergencias del Organismo de Salud del Mundo de la ONU, Mike Ryan, no estaban dirigidos directamente a la tan anunciada